Good evening. It's 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 5th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Current. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, a Queen's University student who inspired a national charity is bringing the first ever Cassie and Friends Run to Kingston, raising awareness and support for children living with juvenile arthritis. Downtown Kingston is gearing up for a brand new music festival this fall as the BIA launches Road Trip, a multi-genre event designed to turn Princess Street into a day-long musical journey. And in hockey's birthplace, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival wrapped up its run this past weekend, bookending the festival with two films exploring the game through a new lens, highlighting stories of marginalized players at a time when hockey culture is a heated topic. Let's dive in. For most toddlers, learning to walk is one of the first big milestones. But for Cassie Port, that milestone suddenly disappeared. At just 20 months old, she woke up one morning unable to walk. A moment that would lead to a diagnosis that would shape the rest of her life. Cassie was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, a chronic autoimmune disease that causes joint inflammation, pain, fatigue, and without proper treatment, long-term damage in children. But what began as a frightening diagnosis eventually grew into something much bigger. The Cassie and Friends Run, a national charity helping families across Canada. I sat down with Cassie, now a third-year health sciences student at Queen's University, to talk about how it all began.
So my name's Cassie, and when I was 20 months old, I woke up and I just wouldn't walk. So I had been walking like the night before, and I just wouldn't walk that morning. And my knee was the size of a baseball. So my parents quickly rushed me to the hospital, where eventually I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So that's a bit different than like rheumatoid arthritis, which is found in older people. So I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JIA. And my parents were searching and searching for support where they could meet other families with children with arthritis and stuff like that. But all they could find was arthritis support for older people. So my dad decided to sign up for the Scotiabank 5K run and raise a bit of money for research and stuff like that. And he sent it to some of his colleagues and his friends and practically overnight raised close to $18,000, which was very exciting. And we went to the run. We cheered on my dad. He ran the 5K. And that day, under the rainy tent, pretty much Cassie and Friends and the idea of it was born. And my parents wanted to be able to support other families like me and that had children like me or siblings like me, so other parents could meet each other, so other children could meet each other, and to raise money for research for juvenile arthritis.
Nearly two decades later, Cassie and Friends is Canada's only national charity dedicated to children and youth living with juvenile arthritis and other childhood onset rheumatic diseases. Cassie grew up attending events organized through the charity, meeting other kids facing the same challenges she did.
Cassie and Friends has always been a great support system for me. We've had events like other runs every single year. I'm from Vancouver, so I would go to the ones in Vancouver. We also had something called Family Day, which is a whole day with activities for the kids and conferences for the parents. So parents will listen to speakers that give them different tips or new research to support their children with arthritis, while the kids would do fun activities for different age groups and get to meet each other and make lots of friends. And, you know, like when I would go to school, no one would have arthritis or do injections once a week like me. So when I could meet other kids that were going through the same thing, it was very nice to have that support. And I've definitely been able to maintain a lot of those friendships.
That experience also helped shape Cassie's career ambitions and ultimately led her to Queen's.
Because I was so in the medical, like, I guess, in the medical world and like immersed in it from such a young age and going to all these doctor's appointments, that led me to become very interested in science. And just like anyone else, I was interested in science. I applied to Queen's Health Sciences and got in, which was very exciting. And I always knew I wanted to do something in medicine because I was so immersed in that world growing up. And as I started learning a bit more and studying, I became interested in pediatric rheumatology, which is the exact kind of doctor that I went to. And I just feel like I would have such a unique perspective for these other kids like me. And pretty much, I just want to be able to help other kids like me. And that's what's led me down the path of medicine and specifically to pediatric rheumatology.
Now studying at Queens, Cassie is helping bring that support network to Kingston. On March 7th, Kingston will host the first ever Team Cassie and Friends run at City Park. The event is organized with the support of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club, which brings together students living with arthritis and other rheumatic conditions.
I have to give credit, actually, to one of the old presidents of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club. She started the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club when she got diagnosed. And the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club brings together Queens students with arthritis and other rheumatic diseases. We make care packages to send to other students with rheumatic diseases that have ice packs and heating pads and injection support and stuff like that, as well as having different events to bring people together. So similar to what Cassie and Friends does to meet other students with the same disease. And we decided to collaborate with Cassie and Friends and host one of these runs because a lot of different communities, like in Hamilton, they do them, in London, there's a lot of different community runs. And we thought, well, we have this club here, so why don't we have a run in Kingston? And that's how it came to be.
In addition to raising funds, the run is also about building community, something that can be difficult in smaller cities like Kingston.
I think that this really raises awareness that there can be rheumatic diseases in students. And the transition to any university is tough, like learning how to live alone and having so much more independence, cook your own meals, all that stuff. You have to adjust to that no matter what. And then when you have a rheumatic disease, there's added things to adjust to. Like I had to learn how to do my injections on my own before my mom had been doing them. Or it's so much colder here than back in Vancouver. And that definitely affects my joints as well. So there's just so many other aspects that you have to think about. And this run and Queens Rheumatic Disease Club in itself can bring all these Queens students together that have rheumatic diseases. And then for the Kingston community, since Kingston, there's no children's hospital here, and I'm pretty sure the closest ones would be like SickKids or in Ottawa. So a lot of these families that have children with rheumatic diseases, they have to travel really far to get their specific treatment. By hosting this run in Kingston, these families are able to meet other families in their community. And it's the same thing that Family Day does or these runs do in other places, is it allows them to meet other families in the Kingston community, especially when there's so few compared to those bigger cities.
Raising awareness is another major goal. According to recent polling, only about 1 in 5 Canadians know that arthritis can affect children. And yet, early diagnosis is critical, as delays can lead to joint damage, chronic pain, and long-term damage. Funds raised through Cassie and Friends support research, family support programs, and improved treatments.
So right now, the main focus of Cassie and Friends is looking for a cure. So a lot of research focus on a cure for juvenile arthritis. But there's also the treatment aspect. So a lot of treatment can be provided to adults, but it's much harder for that to get tested and approved in kids. So there's a lot fewer options. So a lot of the money from Cassie and Friends goes to research, raising money for research for this treatment for children. Like, for example, in myself, I was on a medication all through my childhood where I got an injection once a week and it made me so nauseous, the side effects. Like it handled my arthritis perfectly fine, but it just made me so nauseous. And when I switched to an adult rheumatologist in Kingston, I was telling her about this and I was like, is there anything we can do about the nausea? And I've been asking this forever. And my pediatric rheumatologists were always like, oh, you can try eating a sour candy. You can try watching a show, like things to distract yourself. But when I spoke to my adult rheumatologist, she said, well, why don't you try this pill? She was like, have you ever tried it before? And I was like, no, I've never been offered that. And she was like, oh, well, it's not approved in kids. It's only approved in adults. And this has changed my life completely because now I only do one injection a week because this one has switched to a pill and I get significantly less nauseous. So that's a perfect example of how there's so much more options, so many more options for adults, whereas in children, there's so many less. And this fundraising can provide funds for research for this treatment in children.
Ultimately, Cassie hopes the Kingston Run helps students and families connect.
So firstly, I hope that there's awareness raised around juvenile arthritis and other childhood rheumatic diseases in general, whether that's in the Queens community or the general Kingston community. And as well, I hope that people make friendships and bonds with each other. I hope that parents can meet each other and talk about what they went through, even if it's my dad's coming from Vancouver. So even if it's someone talking to my dad, even if it's not in the same city, just so they have people to talk to that have gone through a similar thing, the children as well, the siblings. I hope that everybody can form bonds and connections that can help them with their disease and diagnosis further on.
Cassie also noted that bringing the first Cassie and Friends run to Kingston has been a true team effort, with support from both the national organization and students right here at Queens.
Yeah, I want to give a big shout out to all of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club exec. They've been great in finding sponsorships, planning the run, getting the cupcakes, everything like that. I've had a lot of help from them. I've had a lot of help from Marissa and Natalie at Cassie and Friends. And everyone has been very supportive and very helpful in planning this run. And I'm so excited to see how it turns out.
Once again, the first Team Cassie and Friends Kingston Run takes place March 7th from 9 to 11 a.m. at City Park. Registration and donations are available through the Cassie and Friends website. Before we get into more local news this evening, I'm going to turn to your weather and traffic report featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 5th, daytime high of 3 degrees, but with the wind and rain in the forecast, it is going to feel quite a bit colder, around minus 7 or so. Friday, March 6th, we've got a possibility of rain / freezing rain in the forecast. Daytime high of 2, overnight low of minus 5. And then moving into the weekend, the warmest weather for the year so far, Saturday, March 7th, daytime high of 6 degrees with a little bit of rain forecasted in the afternoon. Sunday, March 8th, 8 degrees with about a 70% chance of precipitation during the day. And then Monday, March 9th, this is not a typo, daytime high of 11 degrees, double digits at last. And it's going to feel like 11 degrees, cloudy but no wind chill, rain, snow, or precipitation in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week, and here's a quick note on overnight street parking in the City of Kingston. As of Sunday, March 1st, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased. Overnight street parking is now only banned on nights when the weather conditions require it, so keep an eye on the forecast if you plan on parking overnight downtown. In terms of road closures, Berry Street to Queen Street is closed indefinitely for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. On Tuesday, March 3rd, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., King Street East from Clarence to Johnson Street will be closed for construction-related activity at 285 Queen Street. And Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. That's a wrap for this week's traffic report. Until next time, drive safe, everyone.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. A new music festival is coming to downtown Kingston this fall. The Downtown Kingston BIA has announced the launch of Road Trip, a new multi-genre festival set to take over Princess Street and Springer Market Square this September. The one-day festival is designed as a full day of music, local vendors, and community programming, with plans to expand in the coming years. I spoke with Downtown Kingston BIA events manager Sandy Griffiths about the inspiration behind the new festival and what folks can expect.
This has been in the works for quite a while. I was wondering if you could give us the background on where this idea came from for Road Trip.
Yeah, so we ran for decades the Limestone City Blues Festival. So I believe it ran for about 20 years, 20, maybe 22 years. And then we noticed, especially after COVID, that audiences were shifting, the landscape of festivals were shifting, and, you know, people were not attending those sort of niche festivals. So the Limestone City Blues Festival was a true blues festival. And it seemed like the landscape was shifting more towards like multi-genre festivals. So something where there's a little bit of something for everybody and every music taste. So we decided to end the Limestone City Blues Festival in 2024. And then the plan all along was to come back in 2025 with a multi-genre festival. We still, you know, we still wanted to produce some sort of larger scale music event in downtown Kingston. And so the plan was to come back in 2025. And then that changed to 2026 when we received a grant to do a winter festival. So we, you know, we sort of threw all of our energy into Spirit of Winter because we received a grant. So we did that in 2025, knowing that 2026 would be our festival deadline. But yeah, so that was always, you know, from the time we said goodbye to the Limestone City Blues Festival, we knew that we still wanted to create a bigger live music event in downtown Kingston for 2026.
Mm-hmm. And why the name and theme of Road Trip? What kind of brought that on?
Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of experience, in-house experience with blues festivals and blues musicians. But when we were talking something like large scale multi-genre, we decided to hire consultants. And so we worked with two people who are sort of steeped in the Canadian music industry. So Steve Jordan used to be the head of CBC Music, and he's the founder of the Polaris Prize. He actually used to work for CFRC as well back in the day. And then Virginia Clark, who runs the Wolf Island Music Festival, and she's also the owner and operator of Flying V Productions. And they came to us with a proposal, and they came to us with a number of different festival names. And we fell in love with Road Trip for a few reasons. We love the nostalgia of, you know, everyone piling into the car and going on a road trip. We also, we love the idea of Kingston being a great road trip destination for people who are living, you know, Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, or the larger GTA. You know, we are an excellent road trip destination for everybody in those cities. And we're hoping to pull people from those cities for this festival, to show them what Kingston has to offer and, you know, introduce new people to the city.
Awesome. Yeah. And this is going to kind of take over downtown. I was wondering how Princess Street will change when it becomes the scenic route in September.
Yeah. So we will close Princess Street from Division down to Ontario. We will, I mean, first and foremost, we are a business improvement area. And so our mandate is to service our local businesses. So we will be inviting all of those businesses out onto the street to set up special activations, activities. We'll have vendors, food, and we'll actually have three stages set up on Princess Street. So we'll have one sort of higher up in near the hub at Division Street, and then one kind of halfway down, and then we'll have one at the bottom of the street near Ontario. And we'll have music, live music. We'll sort of pivot from stage to stage so that you have an opportunity to see all of the music that the festival has to offer. So you can, you know, see a great live performance, do a little bit of shopping, maybe have a coffee, have something to eat, work your way down to the next live performance. And that's sort of how Princess Street will run throughout the day. And then in the evening, everything will move over to Springer Market Square, which is where we'll have our main stage event. So we'll have four performances on the main stage, including our festival headliner.
Awesome. And have we announced any of the artists yet, or is that going to be rolling out throughout the summer?
Yeah, that's coming sooner than later, actually. So it'll be long before the summer. We're really, really excited. The lineup is something we're really proud of. Again, we've worked with, you know, Virginia Clark and Steve Jordan, and their input has been, you know, so fantastic. Their knowledge, they're just very knowledgeable people. And it is a true multi-genre festival. So it really offers something for every musical taste.
Awesome. And looking ahead, what's the long-term dream for Road Trip? How are you hoping it kind of grows over the years?
Yeah, so we're starting off this year with a one-day festival, and we really are being conscientious in growing the festival in a rate that's sort of sustainable for us and the city and the partners that we work with to put on such a large-scale event. But we do want to grow it to a multi-day festival. So I think over the next few years, you'll see every year we'll sort of add a new feature, whether it's, you know, an evening club night, whether it's an art installation, whether it's extending a full day and having a different site for a main stage. But yeah, I think this is the first year of what we're hoping is going to be, you know, a festival that's around for a long time and that will really come to sort of define downtown Kingston and reinstate downtown Kingston as this really creative hub for music and art.
That was Sandy Griffiths, events manager with the Downtown Kingston BIA. The first Road Trip Music Festival takes place September 12th, with daytime programming along Princess Street and evening performances in Springer Market Square. As Sandy mentioned, the full lineup and ticket details will be announced in the coming weeks. You can keep an eye out for updates at roadtripkingston.ca. A fitting choice for a film festival in hockey's birthplace, and at a moment when hockey culture itself is a heated topic. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is bookended this year by two unique Canadian hockey stories. The festival opens with Youngblood, a powerful reimagining of the classic 80s drama, centering the experience of a young black hockey player navigating the road to the NHL, and closes with a special screening of the final episode of Heated Rivalry, followed by a panel discussion exploring its cultural impact. Festival director Mark Garnis sat down with CFRC to talk about how the festival came to be framed by hockey stories this year, and how despite appearances, it wasn't part of a grand thematic plan. I would say these are fitting choices for a film festival in Kingston, hockey's birthplace. I was wondering if you could, speak to the choice to bookend the festival with two Canadian hockey stories.
Yeah, it was definitely not intentional. It was an organic thing. I don't even know if we've ever played a hockey. Yes, we actually played Hubert Davis's previous documentary that we played. I think it was in 2018. It was called Black Ice. So it was a documentary on black hockey players through the years, and it was quite good. So that's the only hockey film that I think we've played during my 12 years with the festival. And it's quintessentially Canadian, and I think if there was a great hockey film that we could play every year, we would. But I think the reality is a lot of sports films are not always great, and so I think the fact that we get to play Youngblood, which is one of the top Canadian films of the year, it's really well done. It's a remake of the classic, and we get to play opening night. It just feels like it almost feels a little tongue in cheek, but it's like it's a great quintessentially Canadian film. And and then, yeah, you were mentioning that it was bookended by another hockey program or show. We're playing Heated Rivalry. We're playing the final episode called The Cottage, which is obviously available for anybody that wants to see it online. You know, it's been playing for a while now. But we have some talent coming in that are going to talk about it afterwards. And so there'll be a discussion about the show. It's huge. And so I think for us to embrace that and have some people at the festival who can speak to that show's success is, I think it's important for us to acknowledge the impact that this show is making.
Interest in the hockey programming has been especially strong, particularly for Heated Rivalry. Demand was so high that the screening had to be moved to a larger theater after quickly selling out its original venue. I was wondering if you could speak to kind of where the idea came from and how it kind of came together, because I know it came out quite late at the end of last year, and then being able to get a producer from the show, I feel like that was probably pretty big.
Yeah, like it. I think anybody that has anything to do with the show right now is just in such high demand. So I think when we started talking about doing something with the show. So Crave is a supporter of the festival. So we do work with Crave. So I think we had that conversation or that idea going for a while, whether or not we might be able to do something with the show. And I don't know if we can actually get anyone from the show. So I think we aimed high and we were like, oh, could we actually get the stars of the show when we first started thinking about it? And then, you know, as I just mentioned, I think they're doing things like Saturday Night Live now. So they're untouchable right now. But then it's even like, I think made its way through. We were trying to get Jacob Tierney, who's, you know, Canadian film director who we've worked with in the past. And, I believe we've had him to the festival in the early years, but he's just super high demand. And I think they're all also getting ready to make the second season. So we were fortunate enough to get, a producer from the show to see the interest in it. Is crazy. We started it at the Baby Grand and it sold out in like an hour. And so now we've moved it up to the Regina Rosen Theater at the Grand, which is 775 seats, and we've half sold it out in a day. So it's, to me, it's kind of crazy how much interest there is in this show. So I guess that just speaks to its importance right now. And I think people's general curiosity in the show and knowing, I think, that they can talk to some people that had a hand in the making of it is really cool to see that people are showing up in such large numbers for it.
All of this arrives at a complicated moment for the sport itself. KCFF's decision to showcase stories about players from marginalized communities offers both a commentary and a refreshing lens.
I guess I wish I could have said we curated this back in the summer when we were planning at the festival, but it has happened very organically. So I wish I had a better answer for that, where this is part of like some big plan. Our 2026 anniversary was going to be all about hockey and embracing like the moment. But, I think the nice thing about the films that we're showing, Heated Rivalry, Youngblood, is that like they're showing hockey through a different lens. And so I guess to be honest with you, when we first thought about the idea that hockey might be a theme at the festival, there were some like things happening that were not good, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you turn back the clocks to, I don't know if it's a full year from now, but like when the trials were happening with the Canadian junior team, and we're like, and we were talking, I think we knew Youngblood was coming out. We're like, oh, could hockey be a theme at the festival? We're like, this is not timely right now at all to be like celebrating hockey during these trials that are happening for like these awful, awful, awful things that have happened in Canadian junior hockey. So not to bring things down, but like that was a conversation mm-hmm. that we had. And we're like, well, you know, I don't think we should go out of our way to be celebrating hockey this year. But then when we actually saw Youngblood and how powerful it was in a story of a black hockey player, and, you know, and then with the Heated Rivalry craze and showing two queer hockey players and their story as well, it's like, okay, this has come about organically and feels right for us to embrace. And then obviously within Kingston, who, you know, we're the home of hockey, and it felt, I think once we saw the full package of films that we could put on offer, and it felt appropriate to embrace it. But you know, it's hockey's, I think that's why it's important to be showing these films and the show that we are, is because it shows hockey through a different lens, which is, you know, it's refreshing, because that's not always the story that we hear about hockey in the headlines.
Once again, that was Festival Director Mark Garness on this year's opening and closing films for KCFF 2026. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Vai marinheiro, vai vaiem, vai buscar a Laurindinha. Vai marinheiro, vai vaiem, ela é tua, não é minha. Sim, nosso é, com toda a certeza, o programa Atlantis, que transmitimos dos estúdios da CFRC no quadrante 101.9 FM, em sistema de cabo 90.9, aos domingos das 18 às 20 horas, com locução de Eduardo Pereira.
Vai marinheiro, vai vai. Hi, we're Short Walk to Pluto, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. I'm Adam with Sam and Kyle. Yes, you heard that right. The boys are back. It's a full room again. It's been a little while that you guys have had to deal with the substitutes and the B-tier podcasters, but don't worry, the A-tier podcasters are back. I know it's been a long wait, but trust me, it's worth it. Today we're going to be talking a lot about the NHL trade deadline coming up because, I mean, that's like the biggest buzz in hockey right now. It's kind of a quick turnaround, I thought. Right after the Olympic break, players come back for a couple weeks of games, like 2 weeks, and then a trade deadline, bam, right there. And we might be seeing some Olympians getting moved at the trade deadline, which is always a funny thought to think about. But we'll start with St. Louis. Because St. Louis is a team that seems to be selling everything. It seems like all of their long-term players that have been part of the team for the past 4 or 5 plus years are on the trade block. So that's including Jordan Kyrou, Robert Thomas, Colton Parayko, Jordan Binnington. Did I miss anyone else there, Kyle? But I think those are the major players from St. Louis that are all being discussed ending up at new homes after this trade deadline.
Yeah, those are all huge. Colton Parayko is honestly actually the biggest one, just because people like look at his points and kind of forget he's a decent player, but he is a 6'6" right-handed defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
Like that that alone is like such high value, and the fact that he's also a good player and really good defensively, like That's why he's such a highly respected player, because he's just such a valuable defenseman. There's just so few right-handed defensemen.
Yeah, no, I honestly thought that he was going to get picked up by Edmonton. I had seen a bunch of trade packages that the Oilers were trying to get Parayko. They decided to go instead and get Connor Murphy from the Blackhawks, who I kind of like that pickup. I think he's obviously not Colton Parayko, but still a solid.
I stand by my statement. Like Nurse has been a steady anchor on that team. Like they're paying a huge bucks for a guy that sits on the third line.
and
still makes costly mistakes even when he gets minimal playing time. Like it's kind of ridiculous at this point. I mean they would ideally they'd get Parayko, but they just can't afford it because of Nurse essentially.
Yeah, no, and I mean Pittsburgh's or I guess I was talking about Edmonton, but Pittsburgh, Stuart Skinner is another player, former Oiler, that's rumored about getting moved again at the trade deadline. He seems to be a target for some teams that are struggling with goaltending. And goaltending is a major topic as well, like with Jordan Binnington. That is the fact that they've made him available isn't crazy to me, but I can't imagine what the trade package would look like for a player like Jordan Binnington. He just came off taking Canada to the silver medal at the Winter Olympics and has quite the pedigree of being a Stanley Cup winning goaltender. So, Kyle, what do you think a trade package for Binnington would look like? And what teams do you think would be mainly interested in signing a potential franchise goaltender? His contract, I do believe, is up at the end of this year, so I think that he would have to re-sign eventually or test free agency. But is there any teams that have struggled long enough with goaltending that you think could make a move for Binnington?
I feel like a team that comes to mind is the Hurricanes. I don't know. I know that's kind of surprising, but they've had like weird goaltending or inconsistent goaltending.
Yeah.
And they're like a good team. Mm-hmm. So, but they're also like, they've had a horrible track record with trades. 'Cause They seem to get big pieces and then lose them the next day. So I don't know. Yeah. Maybe not them. It would have to be someone that's looking for an immediate push, because I would never sign him for a long-term deal. That's a bad idea. I mean, he's just not going to age that well. I could see him having a couple more years where he's solid, but I don't think he'd be a contending goaltender long-term for sure.
Yeah, and I do have a feeling that he's going to the East. I don't think that he would get traded to another Western Conference team. Just looking at the West teams that are in the playoffs right now, I just can't see it. Like Colorado, Dallas, Minnesota, they all pretty much have their goaltending figured out. Vegas, they've got goalies over there. Anaheim and Seattle, both teams that are kind of got younger goalies. Edmonton, if they could afford, if they could somehow work something out, would Binnington be a benefit to the Oilers? Is it even possible? What would you have to give up? And would St. Louis even want what Edmonton would be offering?
I think the problem that you get run into there is the same thing that happened with the Tristan Jarry trade, where it would be like a kind of a one for one plus assets.
Yeah.
So the question would be, I mean, I guess like you have to get rid of Jarry too, and then take on Binnington. I just think that's huge risk, because they'd also have to sell some other player that's decent. Yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, if you could somehow do like a trade package where you give like Matt, like Savoy, Nurse, and like Jarry for Binnington, and like some sort of pick or two.
Yeah.
Maybe that's worth it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think Oilers have a depth problem, though, so even giving up depth pieces is an issue, too.
Yeah, no, that is the thing, is like the Oilers don't really have the prospects or the youth to give that a lot of teams do. So they're in a tough situation when it comes to acquiring a goalie like Binnington. But in the East, like you mentioned Carolina, they've got Brandon Bussey, who's having a crazy season this year. He's playing really well. But it would not hurt to add an established goaltender like Binnington, especially if it's only for the year. I can't really see that hurting them as much as, like you said, the Mikko Rantanen trade last year. Like I think Carolina they were able to turn out okay, because they got Stankoven out of that, who's pretty good. So I think it still ended up being a win, not so much of a lose for Carolina. But I do think that Binnington could have a place with an Atlantic team. I think the Buffalo Sabres are a team that could make a push for Binnington. I know it hasn't really been talked about too much, but they have right now UPL, I believe, is playing. And is it Devin Levi for the Sabres?
Yeah.
So they, their goaltending is not very experienced. That can hurt when it comes to the playoffs. Oh, not Devin Levi. Sorry. Alex Lyon. So they've got some inexperienced goaltenders when it comes to playoff hockey. And maybe we should talk about the playoff chances of the Sabres first, but I think that this is the best that they've looked at this point of the season in a long time. And I think if you're going to push in for 1 year, doesn't hurt to go after an established goaltender like Binnington.
Yeah, I can see it. You know, it'd be a sneaker one. I think it'd be the Senators. That's a sneaker pick for new goaltending change. They got the worst goaltending in the league. They could use some stability, but the thing is, I don't even think the Senators make it to the playoffs.
Would you think that'd be a one for one with Ullmark? Ullmark and something for Binnington, or? Because
I mean, see, this is my issue, though, is I am a firm believer that like the goal, like Ullmark is not a bad goalie. I just think it's Ottawa is the problem, because this has happened with so many other goaltenders that have like been abysmal in Ottawa, and then they leave and they're like not like they're insane right away, but they've been like decent.
Yeah.
So there's something wrong systematically with the Sens anyways.
Although Ottawa's kind of funky, because it tends to have the opposite effect from what I can tell. Usually really bad goalies play really well in Ottawa, and then really good goalies come here and get completely destroyed. Sort of like we sandwich them in the middle and sort of mediocreness or mediocrity. And then for whatever reason, we just fail to help them get back to being good or make them better than they were before. And then they leave.
Yeah.
How they blossom in a different city.
Yeah, that's a good point, because like when I think of Ottawa, I think of Craig Anderson, right, being the goaltender, and he played his best years of hockey in Ottawa. So like they definitely brought out the best in Craig Anderson, but ever since then, it's tough to think of a goaltender that really played their best hockey in Ottawa.
The Hamburglar.
Oh, I guess you're absolutely right. That is a good one, the Hamburglar.
Ray Emery played some good hockey in Ottawa before he got arrested.
Yes, yep. Rest in peace, Ray Emery. Ottawa is definitely an interesting place for goaltenders. Definitely an interesting place for players, too. I haven't seen too many moves rumored out of Ottawa. Now, maybe I'm just not on the right sources, but does this happen to be the case that they have already given up on the season? Or what do you think here, Kyle? Because, I mean, you said that you don't even know if the Sens will make the playoffs. So what do you think the Sens' position going into the trade deadline should be? Are they sellers?
I mean, they have some of the worst discipline and leadership in the entire league. And most Sens fans will freak out when you say that, because they'll be like, well, you know, some of our top players are really good players. And it's like, they're good individual players.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know how many like players go and they're unbelievable, like skill wise, like junior player, and they absolutely suck as a teammate. Mm-hmm. Those guys don't go anywhere. There's a reason. It's not because like they couldn't be a good player on a good team, but they're just incapable of actually having any hockey IQ. And instead of thinking about themselves in the moment.
Yeah.
Prime example, first game back, Brady Tkachuk takes a penalty and then a major penalty in the box.
Yeah. Was this like, the Detroit game?
I straight up don't know another captain that would have anything as stupid as that happen to them in a game.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, so with that kind of stuff going on, like, I don't know how you expect to win any game.
Yeah.
Like, you just had a captain sit for most of a period. And then, yeah, lo and behold, they lost that game, and that was totally winnable. If he was playing for 12 more minutes instead of sitting in the box, like, or available to play, for 12 more minutes, like, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can't win games like that.
That was the game against Detroit, wasn't it? Like, the first game back? Yeah, because they went on the... I can't remember if they ended up going on a power play or penalty kill after it, but it's whatever Tkachuk's on. And the other guy that got the penalty was the one that fought Edvinson, which I think was Cousins. Mm-hmm. And like he was also on the power play unit or the penalty kill. So you lose two of your best players on that unit, and they're out for a while because Cousins got the 5 minutes for fighting, and then Tkachuk went over and got the unsportsmanlike for jawing at Edvinson from like right in front of the box. Like, boneheaded stuff like that, and just like not really thinking, it kind of baffles me. And I know what you mean. Like you maybe expect that from like a third line guy. Maybe expect that from, let me think, like a Josh Norris.
No, like a Ryan Reeves. Like that's what Ryan Reeves does, and you send him out for 2 minutes a game. It doesn't matter if he sits for 30 minutes because he doesn't play anyways.
No, actually, Josh Norris is more valuable than that. So yeah, maybe like a Nick Cousins kind of player, you know, like someone that's expendable. Yeah. Sam, your thoughts on Tkachuk and the Senators' discipline?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is a recurring theme. I'm not Brady Kachuk's biggest fan in general, but I mean, I just think Ottawa needs a bit of a change of overall leadership.
Yeah.
And one of the good way to go about that is by trading some guys. I think Ottawa should kind of sell the farm in general in that sense too.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't think I have really too much to say. Like, I mean, it is just third line activity. It really is at the end of the day. So sorry, it's kind of repetition, but it's true. But I do think this is a serious question to be had at this point. Like, is it still worth having Brady Tkachuk on the Senators? I don't think so.
I mean, we've talked about this for like 3 years in a row now at the same time. Yeah. Like
even now, as a matter of principle, too, I think at this point, Brady Tkachuk is not someone that the Senators should align themselves with in general. And that extends a bit outside of hockey as well. But I don't think he had the most graceful and eloquent exit of the Olympics. and I don't think the Senators want to associate themselves with that. And he just is not he just doesn't do much good stuff on the ice for the team.
Yeah.
So at that point, what do you get out of him? Good leadership? Apparently not really. Good play? No, even less.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think the other thing, the, you know, Senators have a lot of Olympians on that team. Like, they should be a really good team, frankly. Like, they've got an Olympian forward defenseman, two forwards, actually, and then Was that everyone? Or yeah, they had at least three, but you know, and those were definitely, those are people that were on, you know, first and second lines on top, you know, best of best teams. So like right away you can go, okay, well, we have some of the best players, but yet nothing comes from it.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel for you guys, because it does not seem like a fun time right now in Ottawa, but it could be worse. You guys could be the Leafs, who are 2 points back of the Senators right now. And man, is that a team that is imploding. I saw the clip of Matthews' return from the Olympics and him just getting booed by his own fans. And I, like, obviously I love that. I respect that. Like, standing up for the country. I like that. But what does this say about the leadership of the Leafs? Because, I mean, we talk about the leadership of the Senators, but I can't say the Leafs have been a team where I've been blown away by their leadership the past few years. Should the Leafs be sellers at the deadline? I'm not talking like Matthews and Nylander, but I think they've got some assets that might be expendable, maybe go into a little bit of a rebuild. Like, I think that they're far enough out. And I know, yeah, that's 2 points at the back of the Senators, and I'm not counting the Senators out, but I think they're far enough out that you could make an argument that they're done for the year.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the exact discussion we had last year, where when they signed that massive contract with Nylander, everybody that was with any forward thinking knew what that meant. That meant that they were forfeiting having any money spent on depth.
Mm-hmm.
And they chose that, right? Like, they chose to spend most of their money on their top players. I think the only thing that saves them is an increasing cap.
Yeah.
And then they can work with that. But I mean, like, you look at their roster and you just go like, wow, there's like, you know, they're two, you know, they're both their third and fourth lines for offense and defense are just like, those are just AHL players.
Yeah. No, it's kind of like, I think it's definitely the worst Leafs team that I've seen in a long time, depth-wise and points-wise. I can't say I've watched too many of their games because I feel like they're not really all over the place with the highlights and everything. I feel like Toronto sports media, which, I mean, like TSN, Sportsnet, most of the stuff that I'm watching, is all usually hyping up the Leafs, and this is the first time in a while that I haven't seen that. And you know, it's kind of nice to not have that Toronto like bug in your ear always talking about how they're gonna, this is the year, this is the cup, because it kind of really hasn't been an optimistic year at any point in the season. They got off to a slow start. They're continuing to be slow. They've just kind of been bad all year. But they're not the only ones that kind of have had a dud of a season. Florida also is kind of having a bad season, 1 point back of Toronto. And they're rumored to be potentially looking at trading Bobrovsky at the trade deadline.
That's interesting.
I think that trade would immediately sign that the Panthers are not trying to win this year. Not even trying to make the playoffs this year. So... is there a player on the Leafs, like I said, probably not Matthews and Nylander, that'd be a clear white flag, but is there a player on the Leafs that if they move, you're like, okay, like they're really putting this in park and just tanking to the bottom?
If they move any of their goaltenders,
fair enough.
That would be me saying that they're tanking, because their only bright spots are like their first line and goaltending, I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, whew, not looking too good.
Yeah.
I think the Panthers are way too, like, they've had many, like, multiple years in a row now with you know, cup runs, deep playoff runs. Like, they're beaten up like crazy. Like, they're way too, I mean, I don't know if you watched, like, Matthew Tkachuk much in the Olympics. Like, he doesn't look very good right now. He hasn't looked fully himself in the, like, NHL either.
Yeah, it's not.
Because he's definitely... not 100%. I mean, he did sit for a while, and knowing him, he probably was not following his rehabilitation program to a T. a couple cigar lounges in between here and there probably didn't help the recovery process. Sure, he was practicing every day too.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. No, it really is funny that a lot of the it's just, I just think it's a funny correlation that a lot of the American players that just won gold have to come back to their crappy NHL teams. Because, I mean, you even look at Jack Hughes in New Jersey, like, bottom of the barrel team there. I guess it's a little bit of a different story in the West with Quinn going back to Minnesota, Eichel going to Vegas, but yeah, I don't know. It's definitely an interesting time in the hockey world. Sam, any thoughts on Florida or Toronto before we move on?
On Toronto, definitely. I think Toronto could actually be a good team, but I think they do have to get rid of the first line. I kind of disagree with the notion that they should keep it because they waste a lot of money on it. Yeah. I do think they could round out a better team, but Florida deserves to be bad at hockey right now. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, look, they were good when they shouldn't have been good, and now they're bad and they should be bad. So it's only fitting in my view. But yeah. I do think Florida can still make a comeback because I don't think their roster is actually horrible, but I don't think they're cup contenders this year. Mm-hmm. Toronto, on the other hand, I still think has a cup contending team, but it won't be easily done. And I think Toronto, if I had to guess, probably suffers from the Ottawa plague known as toxicity. And I can't imagine that Toronto has a cohesive locker room. Like, that locker room is pretty split between Canadians and Americans, yeah, and then like a few European dudes. So I don't know. I just have the impression that some stuff is good. It's just tough. Like, 2 years in a row where there's international competition between all the major hockey playing countries obviously leads to some internal drama. Mm-hmm. It's like, in some sense of the word. And like, yeah, usually you can look beyond it, but I don't know. For whatever reason, like, I think the fact that the crowd really hates Matthews right now too, and the fact that he's a bit of a whiner doesn't help him, and it doesn't help the team chemistry either. So I think Toronto's a bit more screwed in that sense than the other teams.
Yeah. Although I will say a Matthews trade would shock me. Like, I would be stunned to see Matthews move, just because I feel like the Leafs are never, they never do trades like that. They never have been like,
until they do.
Well, I mean, I would have thought they would have done that with Marner, right? We were talking about that all the time. Instead, they let him walk for nothing. And it's just like, clearly that's not the management style that Toronto's been going with. I honestly don't know how Berube still has a job. I think that they need to make a change at the behind the bench. Mm-hmm. Because
I don't know what that does though. Like, I mean, they keep changing everyone. Apparently, like, oh, this new GM is supposed to be great. He's going to do phenomenal things. This new coach is going to do phenomenal things. And the end result is the same every single year. It's next season, next season, next season.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, Sam. I think that it's just Matthews and Nylander are not having bad enough seasons for me to judge. If they were having dud seasons, then I think, yeah, definitely we can talk about them getting traded. But they really are good. They're just on a bad team. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I'm still of the belief that Matthews is injured. I don't think he's 100%.
That's possible.
I mean, people reference his contributions in the Olympics, and I just laugh because you look at like who he scored against, and it's like, oh yeah, he put 3 points against Latvia.
Yeah,
like, okay.
Yeah, no.
that's literally the equivalent of scoring like a couple of goals against an AHL team with a not only NHL team behind you, but an actual superstar team.
Yeah,
like that. I do not count that as he hasn't scored in 8 games on Toronto. Yeah. That's embarrassing. I just think he's injured. I don't think that's his fault. I think he's just got an injury.
Yeah. All right, enough talking about these loser teams at the bottom of the standings. Let's talk about the playoff picture, because it's really heating up in the East and it's kind of cooling off in the West. The West, there's kind of been a gap starting to grow between the wildcard teams. Right now, Utah and Edmonton are in the wildcard positions, but Edmonton could move up. Seattle's only 1 point ahead of them. Anaheim's only 3. And Vegas is honestly only 4 points. So the Pacific is pretty tight, but it does seem like a gap is starting to form between the Oilers and the 62-point San Jose Sharks, Nashville Predators, and Los Angeles Kings. Now, the Kings seem to be a team that are trying to be very active at the deadline. They fired their coach. Do you think that LA is in like panic mode now? Because I'm looking at the stats. They've only won 9 times at home this year. It's pretty horrendous. Like, the only other team to not have double-digit wins at home, well, actually, there's 2, the Rangers and the Canucks. But those are pretty bad teams. So do you think that the Kings have a shot? Do you think the Kings can maybe make a comeback? Because they've made the playoffs the last couple of years, and I honestly thought that this was going to be a good year for LA. I thought that this was going to be a year that their deadline, or that their rebuild has kind of progressed enough to the point where they might challenge for the top spot in the Pacific Division. What's really gone wrong there from your guys' point of view?
I think it's a cohesiveness issue, to be honest. Like, that roster doesn't seem to have, like, 100% meshed.
Yeah.
Because they've got the right pieces. But I could see them bouncing back next season and being really good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if they can somehow work out the chemistry, like, now, maybe. But that's usually pretty tough, especially with, like, a bunch of new pieces coming in if they do that.
Yeah, no. And I did forget to mention, too, Kevin Fiala got injured at the Olympics in that Canada game. Mm-hmm. So that is obviously a huge hit to the Kings. I guess that the fact that that happened and the fact that they're kind of close to the playoffs, I just didn't see a coach change coming, maybe, because, like, clearly the Kings are going to be worse off without Fiala, right? So I don't really know if it's the coaching, if it's the coaching issue, right? Like, I was just very surprised to see that, because a lot of the times you see a coach get fired by a team that's, like, in the playoff hunt, they're still expected to make the playoffs. They're almost, like, expected to bring a new guy in and turn the team around, and based off of, like, I mean, we saw it with, like, Chris Knobloch in Edmonton a couple years ago, right? Like, the team's kind of still expected to do well. I don't know. It's just a peculiar situation to me, and I just wanted to know what you guys thought, or if that correlation's there.
I think the problem is they've lost the same way so many years in a row that they kind of just took the nuclear option and just are trying to hit a full reset, I guess. Mm. But yeah, I don't know if it'll work out for them.
Yeah,
they're not a very high goal scoring team at the moment. Like, Kempe's leading the team in points, and he's got 50. Then Kevin Fiala was in second with 40, which isn't that many for the 60 games he's played.
No.
And Quinton Byfield, who's supposed to be their up-and-coming guy, is 33 points. And then defenseman Brent Clark is there with 30 points. 22. Yeah. Which is, like, Kempe only has 22 goals. Fiala has 18. I don't know. I guess I just think that they lack a lot of offensive power. So it might be a bit too late for LA, because I don't think overall they have enough offensive drive to get the job done. And as much as defense does win championships, at the moment, offense does too, which is a bit rare for hockey, but really it does.
Yeah. No, and LA is one of the teams that's interested in Patrick Laine at the trade deadline. So I really don't think, Patrick Laine might be great for the power play, but I don't know if that guy's going to make too much of a difference on your goal scoring front. I want to talk before we finish up here just about Nashville too, because they kind of had a comeback. Like, I feel like the West has kind of gotten worse, and so maybe they just look less bad. But Nashville is a team that, like, I think we kind of all counted out and didn't think that they were going to really amount to much this year. But they're still kind of making a decent effort to try to get into the playoffs. And Stamkos is having a great scoring season, looking like the Stamkos of old. Obviously not as much on the point side of things, but with the goals, I mean, I'm pretty sure he's above 30 this year. So that's a player that I was surprised to see doing well. And I honestly think Nashville's in a spot where I don't think I could see them being sellers at the deadline. I think that they're kind of locked in. If that team makes the playoffs, I think that they could get carried by UC Saros, and they've got a decent offense that I think that they could maybe play upset in the first round. Because, I mean, I don't know. I got a feeling about Nashville, man. There's something about them. If they get in, I would be scared. Because I would rather play Utah than Nashville right now. So,
I was dead certain at the start of this season that they would bounce back from last season.
Right.
It just made no sense. Like, they've got decent goaltending, decent scoring. They've got one of the best D-men in the league.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it's strange. I think the most interesting, though, one that you said is the Oilers, because I actually think that the Olympic outcome is a big deal for the Oilers. It's another, Connor McDavid gets hassled every single day about him not winning.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely not, like, incentivizing him to stay in Edmonton, because, frankly, if they don't make the playoffs this year, I'd be sweating big time.
Oh,
like he might force a trade or move. Like, actually,
yeah, I think the consequences are definitely the biggest for the Oilers. Okay, but next week we will be talking about all the trades that do happen on Friday's trade deadline. So make sure you tune in next week. Thanks for joining us today. This has been Kyle, Sam, and Adam with Plugged in My Ears. Have a great evening.
Winter in Kingston can be unpredictable, but a little preparation can help keep your home safe and your utilities running smoothly. If you live in a house, be mindful of where you shovel snow. Keep fire hydrants visible so emergency crews can access them quickly. Avoid piling snow against gas meters or outdoor vents, as blocked vents can lead to dangerous carbon monoxide buildup. Be prepared for power outages. Keep flashlights and batteries handy, charge your devices in advance, and never use propane stoves, barbecues, or generators indoors. They can produce deadly carbon monoxide. And remember, our crews work in all kinds of weather to keep your utilities running. Help keep them safe by